Welcome to the Media Ministries of Metro Bible Church, located in Southlake, Texas. The following message is by our senior pastor, Rodney C. Brown, Jr. For more information, please visit our website at metrobible.org.
We are continuing a series on joy. And it was supposed to end this week, and I'm going to ask you to show a little grace. I think I'd like to extend it one more week and talk about joy in fellowship, in a biblical sense, meaning joy in partnering with one another in the gospel. And I would encourage you for your time in the Word this week to read Philippians chapter 1. We're going to cover verses 3 through 10. And in fact, I would encourage you to read the whole book of Philippians and read it several times. It does not take long to go through. And I want you to think about those terms of joy and partnership. And we'll close out our series on joy next week. And then by the second week of January, we'll be in the book of Acts. And we'll finish up with that book sometime this spring. But for now, if you will, turn to the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. And I'd like to set the stage for us. The title of our sermon is Joy in the Journey. We've covered a lot with regards to joy, but I would like to have us think through what it means to be joyful in our day-to-day life, because there's something distinctively different about being a Christian. Not something intrinsically better in any one of us, but something distinctively different because of how we understand things now. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, let's look at the first verse. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, who's the author here? I think we know this. It's King Solomon, son of David. He's the last king of a united Israel and reigned from 971 to 931 B.C., 3,000 years ago. But he also refers to himself as the preacher. In Hebrew, it's Koheleth. And the Greek counterpart is where we get the title of Ecclesiastes, preacher, one who informs or convinces a congregation. And in verse 2, he dives into the theme of the entire book right off the bat. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I mean, there's no introduction. There's no, I'm going to ease into this with an exclamation point. Vanity of vanities. It, meaningless. The word means vapor, breeze, breath. Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner describes it for us. A wisp of vapor, a puff of wind, a mere breath. Nothing you can get your hands on. It's the steam off your morning coffee. It appears for just a moment and disappears. It's meaningless. In fact, except for your eyes being able to catch a glimpse of it, it's worth nothing. And he says that's what life is. It's just meaningless. You say, well, Rod, man, this is the Sunday after Christmas. Can't you just give, I mean, it's cold outside, it's rainy. Can you, this is about joy, and this is depressing. And you know what? For the first 20 minutes, it will be. So let me just settle in, buckle up. But there's some good news. What he's going to do in this book, in chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, he's going to not only go through what is meaningless, but he is going to come to a conclusion. And then he's going to do that the rest of the book. So we're getting in a microcosm what this book is about. And I want us to see if we can understand by what he means that life is meaningless. We're not just catching Solomon at a particularly depressing time. He's a brilliant man. He's well thought out. He has thought through this. He's done studies. And he has come to the conclusion that apart from a relationship with God, life is meaningless. Now, I've just kind of given you a spoiler alert, right? So it's not all going to be depressing. And you hope not, and you're at church, right? Look at verse 3. Try to understand his argument here. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing towards the south, then turning towards the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. What's the point? Look at cycles. We see the sun do this. We see wind go up and down, do this. It circles. We see the rivers flow into the sea. They evaporate. They go into clouds. They go over the land. They rain again, and it flows into the rivers, and it just cycles again. But man dies. Man doesn't last. This machine, this ecosystem, this universe outlasts man, and in fact, we're sort of entrapped by it. It was here before us. It lives beyond us. It seems to chew us up and spit us out. It's what philosophers would call the machine. And everything under the sun won't give me answers. The animals can't speak to me. The plants give me nothing. I see all this happens, and I really don't seem to have any impact whatsoever on the universe. Man goes from dust to dust. He's born, he lives, he works, he builds, he dies, and whatever he leaves is either squandered by everyone else or rots and drifts back into the ground. Essentially, man is just part of the machine. By the way, this is the reason, if you've ever taken a philosophy class in college, it is so depressing. Because one philosopher's ideas or answers are really no better than the next guy's. In fact, they contradict one another. I mean, I wish I could just go back, take that philosophy class, take the final exam and just say vanity is vanities. It's all vanity. And get an A. Because that's basically the end result. I mean, if Solomon couldn't come up with anything better, why do we think Socrates could? Well, that's what Solomon does here. He rails against what is going on from a finite perspective. Think about it. All the philosophies of the world without God are basically man climbing his own ladder with no assurance that he gets any higher than the top of his house. And yet he'll tell you why his ladder's best. But there's no assurance. There's no change. There's nothing outside himself. Every other worldview apart from Christianity has no answers. No one comes back from the dead. No one lives long enough to make a difference. No one leaves anything that's really worth anything. And there's no way to test the hypotheses. The smartest guy in the world is going to die, just like the smartest guy that taught him and the smart guy that taught him. They all share the same fate. Cancer isn't a respecter of Steve Jobs any more than he is of the homeless in Nepal. It gets everyone. We all end up at the same place. No matter our intellect, our wealth, our wisdom, no one really gets ahead. And at the end of time, my engraved, walnut, gilded coffin is no better than the pine box of the guy next to me. I remember when I was in high school, I had a really good friend, son of a pastor, who he was a guitarist in a rock and roll band. And I remember hanging out with him in college, and you know, he cut an album, was really, really gifted guy. And I said, so what are your plans? You just going to get your degree and then go on tour? And he looked at me and he's like, I don't know, man, I'm going to be an English major. I'm going to get my PhD. And I just kind of laughed. Well, you know, sure enough, he did. He got his PhD and he teaches at one of the best college preparatory schools in the nation. And I hope he doesn't believe this. But he wrote a poem that has now become very famous that embodies this sort of man in the machine and there is no hope attitude. And I want you to listen to the title. I'm going to bring it up later. The title of it, this is by a guy named Todd Herron, is What is Man That Thou Art Mindful of Him? I'm going to read you a few verses. And if you think you're not depressed already, this will depress you. Man is a weapon of mass destruction. Eliminate man, you don't eliminate the problem. As dog returns to his own filth, so man returns. A swarm, a fungus, feeding on destruction. As when a child I fed upon my dreams, adrift in a pool rainbowed with chemicals, a child already dead, intent on death. Think of the thousands I marshaled to destruction, 500 years having fed upon the earth. He goes on to talk about war and mass destruction. I think back to my mother. I was a man born on earth of a woman. Woman is a weapon of mass destruction. I sleep. I dream my futile, fruitless wars. I dream of peace. The dove-white dawn explodes. Man is a weapon of mass destruction. I know this now. Man's the best rhyme for war. Merry Christmas. I really want to know, does he believe this? But he does eloquently describe vanity of vanities. All is vanity. That everything under the sun, this is the best we can do. And I hadn't thought about it much, but when I was on vacation recently, Joe and I went to an old Civil War cemetery, and it kind of started to make sense. Next to these fabulous mausoleums, you know, 150 years old, with, you know, some high-ranking, you know, general or colonel who had had all these accomplishments in the Civil War, you know, just 10 feet away is an unmarked grave of a private with no name. And I thought, what's the difference? Their rank doesn't make a difference anymore. Their looks, their bank account, who they married, their children don't even make a difference anymore. They've all ended up at the same place. And you know what? I've never heard of either one of them, nor could I remember their name now. There's virtually no legacy. But what Solomon does is he makes a little bit of a turn in verse 8, and he says, even though man sees vanity in all of this, it doesn't stop him from doggedly pursuing it. Verse 8, all things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. Even though people realize things are never going to change, they're never really going to get ahead, we still strive and pursue that which we think will give us, watch this, purpose and joy. Let me say that again. Even though man philosophically knows better, he still pursues doggedly that thing, that created thing, which will give him purpose and joy. Look at your timeless truth there so I can give you some hope in this sermon. Life can only be enjoyed and have purpose if our highest joy and purpose is found in God. And there's the caveat. That's what Solomon is going to end up with as a conclusion. But we've got to go down the journey to understand it. There's nothing new under the sun. Basically, what he is saying is life just cycles on, and we're just a part of the machine. By the way, this is why, for those of you who are old enough to remember the falling of the wall in East Germany, when Reagan said, tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev. That's one reason why communism was such a failure. When you remove God from the situation, you remove all hope. Not only is it front and center that nothing changes, but you remove anything beyond the cage that you live in, the cage of this universe, that everything under the sun will outlive you and grind you into the dust. Karl Marx even understood it. He says, quote, history repeats itself first as a tragedy, then as a farce. You end up in just despair. Let's face it, without Christ, you can't ever get enough, hear enough, see enough, taste enough, accumulate enough, be famous enough. All you have to do is watch one of these Entertainment Tonight shows. And even if you did great things, no one's going to remember it. And even if they remember it, you're not around to receive the accolades. Kind of a silly example, but I always remember this every time I watch ESPN. Okay, Terry Bradshaw. No, he's not just the announcer. He actually did play football way back when they used to wear leather helmets, okay? 70s and 80s. Who did he play for? Pittsburgh Steelers. How many Super Bowls, Mike, did he win? If he doesn't know, if it's not Packers, he doesn't know it. He won 4 Super Bowls. Do you know what he said when he got that 4 Super Bowl ring? Is this all? Is there anything else? I mean, how profound is that? He's reached the very top. No one had done it. And he said, is this it? Isn't there more? But don't miss this phrase, and this is where the hope comes in. Everything is vanity of vanities, and then there's this qualifying phrase. What is it? We can't see it today. Under the sun. It's all vanity. It's all meaningless. Life is worthless. What's the point of life under the sun? And right there, you start to realize, even if you don't understand, you haven't read this book, you start to realize, this is not poetry along the lines of Edgar Allan Poe. There's a glimmer of hope here. This guy's going somewhere with this. And what I want to show you over the next few minutes is five areas of pursuit that are dead ends. That as some sort of hedonistic, materialistic, scientific engineer, Solomon is going to go down each one of these paths, pursuing that which is created before he makes a conclusion regarding this vanity of vanities. Let's look at our first one together. The pursuit of intellectualism. You know what? Before we get that, because I don't want this to be a clinical study like, yeah, I know a guy like this. And if you're like me, sometimes I have a tendency to listen to sermons. This is really good. You know, Joe really needs to hear this. I'm going to get a copy of the CD, you know? This is for all of us, right? I want to address a serious condition among Christians. It's a highly contagious condition, particularly in dense suburban areas where there's a lot of influence, affluence, and education. It is called functional agnosticism. And you're thinking, do I have this? You probably do. Okay? We all have a little bit of it. Functional agnosticism. Gnosticism is a Greek word for gnosis, to know, agnostic, without knowledge. An agnostic is not an atheist. An atheist says, there is no God. I am the highest being of anything in the universe. An agnostic simply says, I don't care that there's a God. There might be, there might not be. It doesn't play into my thinking. Functional agnosticism is someone who has the right doctrinal statement, often goes to church, perhaps even has a good quiet time, but pursues life as if there is no God. You're like, oh, that's offensive. I know, it is. And it's offensive to me too. A functional agnostic embraces a philosophy that things like, one or more, things like knowledge, pleasure, status, material possessions, work, relationships, whatever other than Jesus Christ will give you purpose in life and thus give you joy. So what I want us to do, because I really want the application to just fall off the bone here, as we go through these meaningless pursuits that Solomon does, I want you to look at them as symptoms. And you determine which one of these symptoms of functional agnosticism you have so that you can then kill the lie. All right? So on your outline, when you get to it, just circle it. Don't worry about the guy looking over your shoulder. He's already circled his, okay? The pursuit of intellectualism. Verse 12, chapter 1. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It's a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Verse 16, I said to myself, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who are over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I realize that this is also striving after wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief, and in increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. Solomon says, you know what? First and foremost, if there's anything within this machine that will bring about purpose, the pursuit of intellectualism, philosophy, knowledge, wisdom, that will be it. We actually believe that to an extent, don't we? And who better qualified than Solomon? What do we know about Solomon? Dumbest guy in the world? The wisest. Write this down. We don't have time to look at it now, but 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 5 and following, God comes to him in a dream and says, ask whatever you wish and I'll give it to you. Solomon doesn't ask for riches. He doesn't ask for fame. He doesn't ask for longevity. He doesn't ask for a large family. He asks for one thing. He says, I'm like a child. I don't know how to go in or come out. And yet you've set me as king over Israel. Will you give me, he uses the phrase, a discerning heart? A discerning heart. By the way, number one mark of maturity of a believer is a discerning heart. One who doesn't just know their Bible, but knows how to apply it. Verse 10, it says, God, it was pleasing in the sight of God. And God said to him, verse 11, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life nor riches, nor have you asked for yourself the life of your enemies, but you have asked discernment, I'm going to give it all to you anyway. So he not only becomes the wisest man in the world, he becomes the richest man in the world. He becomes a man of peace, Solomon, Shalom, peace. And under his reign, which is the last of the United Kingdom, it is a glorious reign. They enjoy great peace. So if you were to think, if I'm to find purpose in the life, in this life, surely intellectualism will bring it. Surely knowledge will bring it. We actually believe this. We embrace it. You hear it on the news. Oh, well, so-and-so, this area of the country or this particular people group, you know what? They just need to be educated. And education will take care of the poverty. It will take care of the crime. It will take care of the abuse. It will take care of the drunkenness. And you know what? That's just flat out not true. I remember 20 years ago going to Ireland, which is a poor country, and was amazed at the orderliness of the people. It had nothing to do with education. But that is a lie we bought into, and that's a lie that Solomon bought into. But the thing is that if anyone should be able to find meaning and purpose, it should be him. He's at the top of the intellectual food chain. No one is smarter than him. You know, it's just another side note here. When we remove God from the equation and we make intellectualism our idol, isn't it amazing how stupid we become? You know, our kids are taught beyond the shadow of a doubt that they come from an amoeba and that apes are their ancestors. I mean, if there's anything to just remove all the hope in your life, then how am I any better than the chimpanzee down the street? Well, look at the second one. He realizes that's all dust in the wind. That's vanity. So he starts down the path of hedonism. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. And behold, too, was futility. I said of laughter, it's madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding my body. He basically became a drunk and journaled it. And he said, no, I'm not really just drunk for no reason. I'm going to become a raving drunk because I'm doing a scientific test here. And then he progresses. Pleasure. He goes on a 1960s style pleasure sexperiment. What else do we know about Solomon? How many wives did he have? 700. How many concubines? 300. I'll let you do the math, okay? If this was ever to satisfy someone, Solomon would be satisfied. Of course, he wasn't. We see the same thing today. Stimulating our body with substances, both legal and illegal. And you know, it's interesting, even pagans realize that doesn't satisfy. Even pagans realize there's something grotesque about stimulating and pleasuring your body to the pain of just checking out and everyone else having to deal with you. I mean, it just doesn't work. Lindsay Lohan is the laughingstock of Hollywood. Why? Everyone gets it. There's no meaning. There's no happiness there. It's the height of selfishness. And so then Solomon says, you know what? Then I'm going to pursue materialism. Verse 4, I want you to notice all the pronouns here. I enlarge my works. I build houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made the gardens and parks for myself. I planted them in all kinds of trees and fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself. Verse 7, I bought male and female slaves. I had homeborn slaves. And he goes on and on and on. Verse 10, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. This guy becomes the me monster. If anything could satisfy, Solomon had the resources. You got to realize, this is nothing new, right? I mean, we do this on a smaller scale. How many of us, you fill in the blank, if I could only get dot, 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 then I would be happy. I mean, some of us may have even prayed the prayer, oh Lord, if I could only get that gal, I will never ask for anything again. Or that guy. And then you get married. Oh, if we could only get our first house. Until, oh, there's that house over there that has better schools and a better neighborhood and a three-car garage and a pool. I better shut up before it gets too convicting. We do that. Solomon did it, but he did it on steroids. Do you know anything about Solomon? He spent 7 years building the temple, 14 years building his own house. It says in, I think it's in 1 Kings, that silver was so common in Jerusalem that it was just everywhere. He imported horses and chariots from Egypt. He opened a port on the Gulf of Aqaba. He had trade agreements. Heck, the Queen of Sheba came to see how rich he was. He enlarged the borders larger than they had ever been in Israel. He had more gold trim than Donald Trump, and Richard Branson was a blue-collar worker compared to this guy. He had it all. And so that's not us. Well, let me put it into perspective. We had Christmas just 2 days ago, right? As I look out, I see all the new Christmas duds. There's new sweaters, right? There's new watches, a couple new purses. Big smiles on everyone's faces. Surely this will bring joy. You may not actually say this, but surely this will give me purpose in life. Here's the test. I'm going to ask you this time next year, where are your 2015 Christmas presents? I'll promise you, none of you will be wearing them. I doubt if most of you can even find them in your closet, and most of us will have thrown them on the goodwill pile. That thing which was intent upon bringing such great joy just disappears. It doesn't last. Vanity of vanities. It's like when you got that first car you were so excited about. And then 5 years later, you were just hoping that it would start before you could get off the lot with your new one and that they just give you $500 for it. Vanity of vanities. It didn't bring him joy. Christ addresses this in Mark 8:36. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what will a man give in exchange for his soul? If you're part of the machine and there is no one outside to tell you what meaning is or purpose is, then all you're doing is trading assets. You ever think about that? All you're doing is making mud pies in the sand. My mud pie is a little nicer than your mud pie, but then the rains come and wash it away. Oh, I got your property, I got your house, you die, guess what happens? Your kid blows it like a drunken sailor. By the way, that's what happened to Solomon. He amassed this huge amount of wealth, this huge kingdom. He dies. What immediately happens? What immediately happens to a 40-year reign? Rehoboam gets it, spends it like a drunken sailor. The kingdom is split, and it's in disarray. It's only a matter of a few years before the north is taken over by the Assyrians, give it a little bit longer, the south taken over by the Babylonians, and Jerusalem is in rubble. Not even the temple remains. Well, what's the end result of materialism? Verse 11 of chapter 2, thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. What's the point? He said it's a waste of time. It's like trying to catch the wind. Don't gloss over that. I want you to think about it. Ask your kiddos, Daniel, I want you to try this when you get home. I want you to try to catch the wind. It's windy today. You don't have to catch a lot of it. I just want you to catch a little bit of it. And I want you to bring it next Sunday and show it to me. I mean, you can't catch the wind. So he's using this imagery. This is stupid. He says, that. Now you put whatever you want in there. That person, that relationship, that money, that accolades, that fame, that degree, nothing. You can't hang on to it. Because you can't take it with you. So what are you saying, Rod? Practically, what are you saying? This is kind of philosophic. I'm saying Bill Gates is miserable. Apart from Christ, unless he's become a believer, he's miserable. All the money in the world, the richest man in the world, is miserable. You say, well, how do you know that? Because he's giving it all away. It didn't make him happy. So therefore, he's trying to give it away. Romans 1 makes it clear. People don't give it away out of the goodness of their heart if they're not a believer. He's looking for something else. If Solomon's that way and had everything, and if Bill Gates is that way and had everything, do you really think that if you can just make six figures a year, that it's going to make you happy? Or ramp it up. If you could just make $500,000 a year, is it going to make you happy? If you can just get that house, is it going to make you happy? Solomon says no. Number four, he says, you know what? So I thought about, I'm going to pursue legacy. If you've read anything about our founding fathers, they were great men. This was their idol, by the way. If you just want to understand, a lot of them very moral, a lot of them believers, okay? But if you look at what many of them were pursuing, it was legacy. I want to be remembered well. Verse 12, so I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who comes after the king except what has already been done? And Solomon has a realization, it's like, even if I get that world record, someone else is going to do the same thing. Even if I build that monument, someone else is going to build a bigger one or a taller one. Even if I do all of this, after a period of time, they will forget me. I was an economics major in college. And of course, we studied a lot of different systems and a lot of real world companies. And I remember the hottest company at the time, this is 1989, 1990, was American Airlines. Oligarchy, everyone was studying it because it had the hottest top-notch CEO. And I bet no one knows who he is. His name was Robert Crandall. He was in all the books. He was in all the articles. No one knows of him today. That's 25 years ago. I mean, he's at the top and no one remembers him. So what happens? Well, Solomon does what a lot of us do in verse 18. He grows up. He puts away the drinking. He puts away the girls. He puts away all this other stuff. And he says, you know what? I'm gonna get responsible. And so he pursues labor. Maybe being a good worker, industrious type of fellow, that'll make me happy. Verse 18, thus I hated the fruit of my labor, which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to a man who will come after me. He says, after all this work, I realized something. I got to leave it to a fool. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. And sure enough, as I mentioned, Rehoboam willed it all away. And in verse 20 and 21, he falls into such great despair that he appears to become suicidal. Verse 20, therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor, which I had labored under the sun. When there's a man who has labored with wisdom and knowledge and skill, and then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, this too is vanity and a great evil. Rehoboam was so grotesque in his disrespect for his father. Solomon wasn't even cold and he was insulting about him. What was it worth? 40 years of hard labor. And so he comes to this conclusion, the wisest of all men who has tested himself with hedonism, with education, with pleasure, with materialism, with labor, with all these things. And he says, if wisdom doesn't fulfill and pleasure and wealth don't satisfy, and if work results in no net gain, what is the point? Why don't I just die now and cut this rat race short? And he says, let me answer that question. Remember Solomon's caveat? Vanity of vanities. It's all vanities. It's like striving after the wind under the sun. Under the sun. And he says, hold on. But what if there's something above the sun? So far, everything has been in relation to a finite man in a finite universe with no one thing, no one system, no one reason, no one with information that can help him out of the machine, and yet everything around him outlasts him. What if there was something that outlasted creation? What if there was something before? What if there was something after? What if there was something above the sun that could reach down into the finite universe and lift man out of it? Not just a higher power God, but one who chose to reveal himself in relationship, in attribute, in glory. What if someone was willing to become part of the creation to lift man out of this mess that he's gotten him into? And Galatians 4:4 comes to mind. But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, so that he might redeem those who were under the law, and we might receive adoption as sons. What if someone might reach down from above the sun, as it were, metaphorically, who might sink himself into human flesh and lift man out of this grinding cosmos and say, not only am I, the infinite, willing to have a relationship with the finite, but I am willing to take the finite and make him eternal. And bring him into relationship with me and have him outlast the creation and spend eternity worshiping the infinite. Now that would bring purpose, right? That would kick to the curb materialism, and that would kick to the curb education. That would kick to the curb even your best relationships, because everything would truly be meaningless in compared to having a relationship with that God. God reaching down to man would change everything, and it has changed everything. Things would no longer be the pursuit of meaning and satisfaction, but would rather, they would become the appetizers to the great feast of God's goodness. They would become the dinnerware upon which his great feast and meal was given to us. They would become the appetizers that could be set aside. They add, but they don't, they complement, but they're not the main deal. Now look at his conclusion. Verse 24, there is nothing better than for a man to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This is also I have seen from the hand of God. And here's the key, verse 25, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? In simple terms, when you find meaning and purpose outside the finite with the God of the universe, Jesus Christ, who spoke the worlds into existence, everything else becomes icing on the cake. You don't look to things for satisfaction. You don't look to things for joy. You don't look to things for meaning. You look to God for that. And you thank him for things as just good party favors, just good gifts. How do we know this? Well, the Westminster Divines say it well. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. And when you glorify God, and when you enjoy him, then you know what? Things become enjoyable, not the source of our joy. Things can come and go, but the source of our joy and purpose remains. And then anything God gives you is a good gift. But there's one more caveat. Look at verse 26. For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. Basically, the only people that can have purpose and who can enjoy God are those who glorify him. And how is God glorified? When we no longer seek to build our own kingdom, but we bow the knee to His. When they've transferred their allegiance from glorifying self to glorifying God. In simple terms, those are the only people that can enjoy life because they're the only people that enjoy God. They're not at enmity with God. In simple terms, believers. Let's get to the practical. So how do we do this? We're walking out of here today. How do we really find joy in the journey? Well, if you want to enjoy the journey, you've got to enjoy the Creator. And then the creation will be enjoyable. Let me say that again. That's what I want you to leave with here today. If you want to enjoy the journey, enjoy the Creator, and then the creation will be enjoyable. How do we enjoy His creation? Well, we enjoy it as gifts. That means enjoy a good meal, but don't make it an idol. Enjoy a good glass of wine, but don't use it to numb your problems. Enjoy a fun vehicle if you can afford it, but don't worship it as some sort of glorified sheet metal with four rubber tires. Ask yourself, am I pursuing this because I believe it will bring me joy, or am I already experiencing joy? And you can take or leave this thing much in the same way you could take or leave a side dish to a good steak. It's great if it's there, but if you take it away, I'm not really going to miss it. Let me leave you with this. Christians are the most joyful people. And throughout history, the most joyful people, Christians, have oftentimes been the poorest of people. And what does that tell you? Their joy is not found in things or in other pursuits, but in the pursuit of Jesus Christ. You know, I opened with that really depressing poem. What is man that thou art mindful of him? The truth is, my friend didn't make up that title. He found it in Psalm 8. And even though David uses some of the same words, the perspective is much different. And I would like to leave you with that psalm. You tell me if this doesn't put things in perspective. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our God, how excellent is thy name upon the earth. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Only for those who don't know Jesus Christ. Father, we pray that you would send us out here today with hearts full of joy and things and the creation in its proper perspective, that we may enjoy them as good gifts from your hands, but that our true enjoyment, our true purpose, our true passion and pursuit would be to live and love Jesus Christ. It is in his great name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to today's sermon. If you would like to hear more messages from Metro, please visit our website at metrobible.org.